This is the Medicast Live, November 13th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast Live. This is the episode we'll be discussing wilderness medicine tonight. And I have a few esteemed guests with us this evening. First of all, I'd like to welcome our special guest for tonight from Wilderness Medical Associates, Dr. David Johnson, who is the medical director and president of Wilderness Medical Associates. And David, thank you for joining us all the way from Texas. You're away on an educational trip right now, I believe.
That's right. I'm doing a Wilderness Advanced Life Support course in St. Marcos, Texas.
Excellent. Excellent. I guess we'll be getting more into exactly what that means a little bit later on in the show, but thank you very much for making the time to join us here on the program.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
I also have with us our standard guest on the show, Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal All Hazards podcast. Rick, thanks for joining us again tonight.
Amy, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And also, lost from the cold, in from who knows where he's been, John Bignell is back in town. John, thank you very much for joining us, and I guess this means that EMS Live is ready, or getting close to the end of its refit and ready to start producing again?
Soon. We're going through a lot of changes, so yeah, we're quite excited to be back on track, and there's been a lot of changes, so we're quite excited about our new format and what we're doing on the webpage.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing more about that, and maybe we can sneak in a special interview for the Medicast Weekly. Let my listeners know what's going on when you're ready to go ahead and launch.
Fantastic.
Excellent. And I also have my chat room buddy there in the chat room, Chris, Easy822, Chris Black, a good friend of the show, will be handling answering chat questions and raising chat questions. So, Chris, it's nice to see you. All right, we're going to go ahead and get started here. When this question was brought up by listener Jason from Montreal, and Jason had taken a wilderness EMS class and really had a question for me that he wanted to see a discussion on the show about wilderness EMS and what exactly that means. And I live in the state of Maryland. We have a statewide protocol in the state of Maryland. And so I knew about wilderness EMS because it's that appendix at the back of the protocols that I have to add in there. And I know it's there, but I never really have looked at it. It doesn't really pertain to my area, so I don't pay a lot of attention to it. But I understand that there are things that need to be handled differently in that type of a situation. And I did a little research and found out that Wilderness EMS really has gone through a lot of the changes in timeline that we've seen here in, I think, the rest of EMS world. Started back in the 60s with Mountaineering Freedom of the Hills book, included a chapter on first aid in the mountains. That was in 1960. In 1967, a book called Medicine for Mountaineering was published. And those really started the thought process of dealing with wilderness-based emergency medical care and addressed first some of the major concerns. And I'm going to turn over the question now to Dave Johnson. And Dave, I'll ask you the question because I know Wilderness Medical Associates has been around for probably almost as long or as long as the other major providers of education in this field. What's your understanding of the history? How did Wilderness Medical Associates get into this game?
Well, we got into it in the early 80s, but I think it started with really even further back than what you had suggested. Folks would come back from the Second World War. They had Mountain Division training in wintertime. And a lot of those guys ended up going back into civilian life and working at ski areas. And so they brought some of the training that they had gained during the Second World War and integrated it into ski patrols. And slowly, probably sometime in the late 70s, that information got transitioned into the park services, rangers and such. And we got involved in the early 80s working with Outward Bound. Wilderness Medical Associates initially was located in the state of Maine. One of the big Outward Bound schools is off the coast of Maine in Hurricane Island. And we found that the solution of calling 911 didn't always work. Either you didn't have a telephone or 911 couldn't respond in a relatively short period of time. And we needed to evolve some training that would deal with the situation where the transport times or response times were prolonged. The environment sometimes were relatively harsh and unpredictable. And we knew the tools that we'd like to have, but we didn't have them. And really, that's probably a good definition of wilderness medicine. When we have harsh environments, prolonged contact or transport time, and inadequate inadequate tools, improvised equipment, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I guess that level of improvisation is beyond what we even think ourselves being so clever with here in relatively more urban areas. Even in my area, I consider where I am having a 20-minute to half-hour transport to the nearest hospital being far from the hospital. But is there a time limit? Is there a distance that you use as a standard for when wilderness protocols need to be in effect?
Well, we have traditionally said 2 hours, just because somebody likes to have a number. And the 2 hour is really kind of predicated on the idea that ischemia develops in tissue sometime after 2 hours. Okay, so, outside of your heart or outside of your brain or your spinal cord, you start to see changes in ischemia as a result of impaired flow, say from an angulated fracture or a splint that's too tight, starting in 2 hours and then developing from there. So the protocols that we use and have been using for the over 25 years is predicated on that 2 hours. But really, I would almost, in more broad terms, I would say that wilderness, to use the protocols, would be when transport to definitive care results in unacceptable risk to the patients. And using these protocols can reduce the risk and improve patient outcome. And so that could be, it could be even shorter than 2 hours. You may be fairly short distance from a hospital with somebody who's got a dislocated shoulder, but the only way to get them is to climb up an uneven scree slope. They're not going to want to walk, and so now we're going to have to carry them out over rough terrain where we could reduce the shoulder at the bottom of the hill, and then it becomes a walkout. So that would be an example.
No, that's a great example, and, I guess that's something to consider. You can be in a situation where you can't get help quickly, even if you're relatively close to standard help.
Yeah, and really, wilderness, the idea that most people have of wilderness is trees, woods, mountains, and lakes. But, wilderness, if you think about the time and the equipment and the environments, could be really in an urban environment with a natural disaster or a human induced disaster. So you could be in a downtown and have a hurricane and have the hospital become non-functional, and all of a sudden, even though you're in an urban area, it becomes a wilderness in a sense.
Oh, that's interesting. That kind of falls into your realm there, Rick. Rick does a show dealing with disaster preparedness for all responders, from the first responder in the field all the way up to hospital personnel. Rick, that sounds like something you talk about all the time.
Yeah, and that really does fit in with the model of the prolonged triage and the protracted on-scene times that can be seen after earthquakes or building collapses or even during what some might consider routine snowstorms or blizzard conditions. That you know, there's definitely an analogy to be drawn between the two. It's very interesting.
How do you convince your captain and the guys that pay for your education that this is relevant to your urban training, that taking this wilderness first aid could transcend into your daily activities? How do you convince them of that?
Well, I think one of the ways is that it encourages people to think about things in a different way. In our courses, particularly when we're training EMS practitioners, is to we don't ignore the idea of a diagnosis. You know, a lot of some people, you know, I think it's much better now, but many people who would train EMS practitioners would frown at the idea of a medic making quote-unquote a diagnosis. And yet, really, to effectively treat somebody, to make a decision whether you have a problem or not, you have to make a diagnosis. And it may be that you're not making a diagnosis with an x-ray machine or a lab, but you still have to make a decision about whether you got a problem or you don't have a problem. And so one of the things that we would do is encourage people to be clear and to have the freedom to make a diagnosis. You know, this is a spine injury or it's not. This is a femur fracture or it's not, rather than it might be or rule out.
That's a good question though, there, John. I mean, this is a protocol, and you talked about this, David, as well. You said that this is a protocol that's been around for 25 years. How did that protocol originate? Is there a national standard that all the agencies that are teaching this protocol are using, or is this something you all kind of adapted yourselves?
This is what we try to do is look at EMS curriculum, the DOT curriculum in the early 80s, and look at some treatment areas where we felt we could train EMS practitioners and first responders to execute a plan that was reasonable, teachable, very doable, and could change the danger of an evacuation or improve morbidity, if not mortality. And we identified, you know, six areas that represented a standard of care outside of standard EMS. And what we try to do is not define the where or when to do it, other than be in a wilderness context, but really how to do it. And the procedures really are no different than what we might practice in the hospital, but they're procedures that we felt we could train people to do. And we have, I believe, successfully trained people to do in a wilderness context. And the protocols that we have are for reduction of some simple dislocations, spine evaluations, stopping CPR, wound management, particularly wound cleansing and dealing with impaled objects, using epinephrine for anaphylaxis, and using epinephrine for refractory asthma when a patient's in respiratory failure.
So it's basically taking the existing curriculum and expanding it.
Yes.
And I noticed that the classes that are offered, generally, I guess they build upon a person's existing EMTB status or paramedic status, and then add on top of that with a 5-day class, it looks like?
Yeah, we have what we call an EMT upgrade, which is the wilderness component of EMS, and that's a 5-day course. And then we have a wilderness advanced life support course for the equivalent of some EMTIs that are using medications and certainly EMT paramedics, and then doctors, nurses, and PAs, you know, mid-levels and docs to take. And that's the course that I'm doing right now is one of those latter courses.
What would be included in an ALS version of that? You talked about the BLS as far as reduction, dislocations, identification of fractures. How does the ALS extend the existing ALS standard into a wilderness setting?
Again, we basically, you know, we assume that everybody knows how to do good patient assessments. They understand good physiology, pathophysiology, and pharmacology. And what we do is look at some of the science involved in the protocols that we use for lower levels. And then we talk about where ALS is appropriate and where it's not appropriate in a wilderness setting, you know, so that everything that an ALS practitioner knows how to do doesn't necessarily fit in a wilderness context. And we talk about how to make those decisions. And we do that through lectures. Every night we have homework assignments or case studies. And the case studies are, we set the scene. So one case study, the case studies that they have tonight, for example, for homework, in one of the situations, the person doing the homework assignment is an ALS practitioner who is working as a medical control. So they're on a radio talking to some first responders in the field. And another one might be that they are an ALS practitioner working for a SAR team. So what we would ask them to do is not only come up with a problem list of what's going on, what's going to evolve over time, over hours, and what the treatment would be, but how would they prepare themselves? You know, if you were a SAR medic in this circumstance, what would you normally take? You know, what kind of ALS treatments would you have available to you? And why would you have them? And what would be the limitations of that stuff? And what kind of things wouldn't you bother to take?
That's interesting, and it brings to mind something that really jumped out to me when I was reading through some of the protocols that I had found doing a little research on this. We talk about, you know, our basic assessment in EMS as one of the things you want to do when you do your initial assessment is assess the number of patients and then determine if you need additional resources. And that determination is really important and in a wilderness EMS setting, because if you get that tunnel vision and start digging into something, you can delay for a significant amount of time. If you've got resources that are 2 hours away, you need to start them sooner rather than later.
Right. And on the other hand, you want to make sure you don't call for help when you don't need it. So part of this is not just coming up with a diagnosis or a differential diagnosis is rule out or could be, but also to be able to say this is not shock. This is not a spine injury. This is not a traumatic brain injury that we have to worry about increased intracranial pressure. So sometimes it's not only important to know what you have, but it's equally and sometimes more important to know what you don't have so you don't pull in resources. And I think you also need to know when is this problem serious enough that people have to take an extra risk to come out and rescue you. You know, which of these injuries can spend the night in a tent? And if you do spend the night in the tent, what do you want to have available to use?
That's an interesting comment, because I don't think any of us have ever thought about having to spend the night with a patient before. Maybe, Rick, you have, thinking about long-term consequences of disasters. But
I'm sure he has.
Well,
go ahead, Rick.
Well, I was just thinking the one item that I think wilderness medicine really brings to the table is the awareness of the environment and the environmental issues and how they're going to impact patient care. Where, even in the disaster setting, in the urban environment or the suburban environment, we're talking about creating congregate care centers and shelters, kind of the shelter mentality, where we're going to be able to get in outside or get inside away from the elements. And what we're really discussing here is a deeper need for the awareness of the environment and how that's going to play a role in our care, the impact on the provider as well as the patient. It's a fascinating parallel to the disaster situation.
Yeah, and that, I think that's a really good point, is that, you know, these practitioners who are doing this not only have to be concerned about the patients, but they need to be, they really need to be paying attention to their teammates, you know, the people that they're working with. And one of the metaphors that I use on this course a lot is that whether you got MD or DO behind your name, you're the doc for the group. You know, if you're the person with the highest level of care, not only do you have to be paying attention to the patients, but you need to be paying attention to your teammates. And if you've got a patient who's hypothermic, given the nature of the environment that caused the hypothermia, you know, all of your team is vulnerable for the same problem.
Yeah, you end up with a lot of, I guess, if you're the wilderness EMS person in a group environment, you end up really starting to look at everybody's health. I guess you deal a lot more with long-term dehydration effects and things like that.
Blisters, wound care. I mean, you know, just go down the, you know, go down the line. Cold injuries, frostbite, you know, trench foot, sunburn, bug bites. You know, how do you prevent this stuff? When does it matter? When do we have to be worried? When do you not have to be worried? And then all the mundane stuff, I think, again, probably that Rick is also aware of is the GI stuff, you know, the nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, how to prevent it. When does the person who's having vomiting and diarrhea, when do we need to be excited about them and when not? You know, when is it a big deal and when is it not? So it's not just the emergency stuff, but it's the kind of the routine medical care, which, you know, most of us don't, you know, particularly as EMS practitioners, have to contend ourselves with because our patient contact time is generally fairly limited.
Rick, you had a comment?
Yeah, I think you're really going down that same road that we look at when we talk about extended care or shelter care, or care in the congregate care facilities or the shelter-in-place activities and reaching out to those people that are stuck inside or sheltering in their home. And that is an area where traditional EMS is really not prepared as it stands today to step up in all areas to manage that. And it also speaks to using the resources that we have as far as triaging the medical complaints of the patient, especially when it comes to nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, and preventing that dehydration situation and a whole host of other things. And it's, you know, it's just, I think that the two really do feed off each other, and it's pretty impressive to hear.
Yeah.
I find it kind of interesting when you look at the whole idea of, the psyche of the EMT and paramedic. We're very much trained that we will pick up a patient, we'll treat, we'll transport, and hand over care. When you get into wilderness first aid and wilderness medicine, you're dealing with, we have to stay here. And I can't hand off my patient. I'm going to be stuck with this patient for extended periods of time. And that's really not part of our psyche. And it's really a change of philosophy when it comes to, well, I can sit on this patient because I'm going to hand him off to someone else momentarily.
And it may be that you decide in the field that this person doesn't need to be transported. You know, the paradigm is we get called and we respond and then we bring them to another place. You know, the care could end in a wilderness setting. The care can actually end with the EMS responder.
I've got a bunch of comments coming in on this in the chat room, and I'll go ahead and read them off for those of you that can't see that. But Jason from Montreal really wants to stress that the simulations are one of the things that make the classes so interesting and so valuable. And Helen, who's in the LA area, also agrees. She said something about doing a night scenario in a snowstorm really makes it seem real. And I think that's true. I think scenario-based EMS education is something we're seeing more and more of. I know that the PEP class has gone in that direction very much. The Advanced Medical Life Support class is the same way. And it's nice. I think that this is equally important in wilderness medicine. Also, Eddie in the chat room also wants to say that agrees with John and Rick that long-term care in EMS is something that's just completely opposite to what we think about. And you're right, we think about handing off care all the time, but you have to think about things like, as Jason says, water, food. Patients as well as rescuers need water and food. There's just extra logistics involved, and if you've got to trek in water and food along with all your EMS gear, it comes back to what you said, Dave, earlier about you need to figure out what it is you think you're going to need.
And one of the things that we stress on, you know, whether we're doing a case study for homework or case studies in class or doing a simulation, is not only, you know, we want to know what the problem is, but what is the problem going to become? You know, what's the anticipated problem? And the anticipated problem relating to the illness or injury that is the initial complaint, but also what can evolve from that complaint and what can evolve from the environment. You know, the environment not only can cause problems, it can make the initial complaint worse, or it can bring out a pre-existing problem. You know, you got a diabetic who's got good diabetic control. You take the person out into a cold environment where you're stuck for a while. They have peripheral vascular disease. You know, they're more prone to having diabetes or to having frostbite, for example. So they end up with a problem, and maybe the call is for, you know, a dislocated shoulder or a traumatic brain injury or something else. You know, we've got to be concerned about problems that are distant from that initial call, the initial complaint for the call that was we received. So you need to be thinking about all of those things. You know, what can go wrong over time?
Yeah, and there's talking in the chat room right now about the point being that you're responsible for the entire group, the other rescuers, as well as the patient and the patient's companions. And you really have to look at the big picture. And this comes back to that management of the scene and scenario that I know Rick and I know John, of all of us, have talked about in our shows at different times, where we've addressed the point of you need to kind of not get tunnel vision and back off and look at the management of the whole picture. And yet this is even a bigger scenario to look at, where you're really responsible for crowd control and animal control and everything else that goes into it.
Yeah.
Something I noticed.
Jamie, I've got a...
Go ahead, Rick.
I've got a point I just wanted to bring up regarding the health and fitness of the provider as well. We're used to pulling up to our ambulance and, you know, maybe going up a couple flights of stairs or down a couple flights of stairs, whatever the case may be, carrying our equipment. But in the wilderness medicine situation, don't you think the provider needs to have a completely different level of physical fitness in order to carry not only themselves but their equipment into a scene for, you know, potentially miles, I don't know, you know, a couple, 10, 20 miles maybe, and then be prepared to stay there and manage care and get themselves and maybe the patient out? Could you comment on the physical fitness aspect?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great point, and it's obviously one of concern. And you know, you can't take somebody from, you know, an urban setting who's not terribly fit and isn't familiar with the environment and then drop them in someplace with polyester pants and a cotton shirt and expect that they're going to be able to survive. So one of the things that we try to do, particularly with the with that EMT upgrade, is to give people a sense about where they're going and understanding what their roles and responsibilities are likely to be in a different environment and the physical challenges involved, and they can be considerable.
I know we all know at least. I'll be generous here and say we all know at least one person in our own services who would never survive a long trek in a wilderness setting, because I think that the physical fitness as a whole in much of the EMS setting seems to be below what I think it should be. And the silence continues.
I think that's everyone agrees with that. I think that's a statement that most people look at our profession and go, wow, we could do a whole lot better.
Yeah.
When it comes to physical fitness.
You know, and just for our general health, you know, forget job protection, just for our own well-being.
But again, if we were to draw that analogy to the disaster situation in the urban or suburban environment, without the wilderness component, it still raises concerns of medics that, or even firefighters, are going to be able to scramble up a debris pile or trek a distance into a neighborhood that's impassable by motor vehicles because of downed trees or what have you. And it speaks to the amount of equipment that we'd have to carry from our rigs to reach these patients. And then having the wherewithal and the physical stamina to get back out.
Yeah. You know, and you end up with an extra patient. You know, you walk in with six practitioners, six rescuers, and one goes down because of an illness or an injury, and it changes the calculus dramatically.
Yeah, and it comes back to that. You know, I'd be interested in asking you, because one of the things I talk about a lot in my show, Dave, is being aware of scene safety and what's going on around you at all times. That it's, you know, it's not the patient in front of you that might have a gun that usually gets you. It's the other guy that's sneaking up behind you that ends up getting paramedics hurt in many cases. And I wonder, you know, how you all address the point of scene safety when not only the patient may be a danger to you, but the hazards of a natural environment when you're trekking someone out over rough terrain.
Well, I think the most effective way to do it is to have an understanding about the implications of the environment. So if you know how you get cold, you can prevent it. If you know how you get heat-related injuries and you're aware of it, you can prevent it. So I think a knowledge of the environment is probably the most important thing. We really believe that people do better by not memorizing. They do better if they understand concepts. They understand the basic science behind how things go wrong, and then they can predict what they need to do to prevent it. And it's not a formula. You know, you don't always do the same thing. You know, you could become hypothermic because it's really windy. You could become hypothermic because it's really cold or because it's wet. And your response, depending on what that environmental challenge is may vary to some degree. And so you need to understand those factors. If you understand how you can get cold, you can prevent it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of people ask me what the difference between EMT and paramedic is. And I try to explain to them that the reason all that extra school and time in the field and time in clinicals is there, at least in my understanding of what impact it had on me, is that it was that need not just to have a cookie cutter cookbook approach to what I do to the patient, but to understand underlying pathophysiology and to be able to address the problem that is going to happen and not necessarily what I'm just seeing at the time.
I think that's true. And as a physician, I can say this. One of the concerns that I have for EMS is that the expectation for the increased expectation for more training for the paramedics doesn't necessarily always translate into increasing a sense of responsibility and independence on the paramedic. So if we're going to train people, we're going to train people with more information, more skills, then I think we need to have some trust level to allow people to use the training and use the skill and the knowledge that they have to work with a little bit more freedom. And one of the things that's really attractive for me about EMS in wilderness medicine is that that has to happen. You know, there's a greater need for independent action. And I think we've shown with wilderness medicine that people are up to the task.
I definitely agree that I think that most of us are up to the task. We just need to kind of shift our mindset. And it seems to me that what you're talking about really is shifting that mindset to think in a different way about certain problems. And, you know, we think differently when you're 10 minutes from the hospital and you have plenty of nice paved roads to get you there. You can relax a little bit more about certain situations because you know you can get to the ER pretty quickly.
But you also have to have medical control that's willing to loosen the reins.
I can imagine that would be a problem because I guess if you're working under a situation or under a command structure that doesn't want to release that ability to think on your feet in the field, that can be a problem. And I've had this discussion with Rick before about, you know, it's the guy on the ground that really needs to be the one that makes a final decision in some cases that, you know what you're looking at.
You're there. You're seeing it. You should.
Sorry, but to say that in the UK, when the guys up there, they have a final say. When they call on medical control and they want to give a thrombolytic, they consult a doctor, but ultimately if they disagree with the doctor's decision, they're the person closest to the patient, they're the one with the best perspective of the patient's needs, and they can deliver pretty advanced protocols without the doctor approving it, which is really unheard of in our North America system.
Yeah. Well, the Canadians, particularly the flight programs, have a lot more independence as practitioners as well. You know, I mean, I think the medical control model that makes most sense, at least to me, that makes most sense is to have, medical control, whether it's online or otherwise, is basically a consultant rather than your director telling you what you can and can't do. You call because you have a question. You call because you want to consult with somebody because something seems not so clear and get a second opinion as opposed to wait and be told that you may or may not do something.
John, do you see that? Because I guess where you are, you deal with Canadian medical services all the time. So can you speak to that or your comments?
I don't know if it's definitive to just Canada. I think it depends on your system, depends on your region, depends on your medical director. I think in Nova Scotia, the region I work out of, it's pretty decent. I have to say our online physicians are more of a coach, a role model. You know, I'm stuck with this. What do you think? I want to increase my morphine. What's your thought? But it really comes down to our original protocol and the final outcome. And it's kind of one of the situations that if you don't screw up, then it's okay. But your medical control physician is more of your consultant, as Rick was saying. And it's I think it works well. We certainly don't have the autonomy that UK paramedics have, where they can say, no, I don't agree with you, doc, hang up the phone and do whatever we want to do. They still have, to some degree, the final say, or at least within our scope of practice.
I was not aware that the UK had that much latitude, but I think maybe we'll need to look at EMS overseas in one of the future episodes here, because I'd be interested in bringing in some of our other services around the world and talking with them about this topic, because I think it'd be interesting to see how our protocols expand. Moving on to a little bit of a different topic here, came up a little while ago in the chat room from both Jason and Helen about what kind of supplies, when you're talking about what you need to carry in with you and you've got to pick and choose, are there a few definitive things that should always be in your kit?
I would say not. I would, if there is, I'm not sure that I know what that list is. I would spend my time and my effort knowing how to use what I already carry with me. I would go through a jump kit and decide what things really just don't make sense. And then I would have a good sense of principles and how I could use what I have to make it work. There's a lot of technology out there. There's a lot of equipment that really doesn't pass muster. It's advertised to do a great job, but it really does. And I think clot enhancers are a perfect example. A lot of hype, but really when the rubber hits the road, they don't work that well. And I think to practice good wilderness medicine requires taking a good, honest look at the equipment that we use and ask the question, is it appropriate or not? I'll give you a good example. One of the things that we have de-emphasized over the last 5 years is traction splints. And, we encourage the practitioners who take our courses to find alternatives to using traction splints for a variety of reasons.
Helen speaks up in the chat room and says, duct tape rules. And it seems like duct tape now 1,002 uses. So I guess if you don't have a definitive item, if you have a basic first aid kit with you, if you are able to improvise, if you're able to look at the surroundings and make judgments about effects of the area, effects of the environment, long-term aspects of whatever apparent injury you have, that you can really do a lot with very little if you use your head.
Yes. I think that's true, and it also makes sense to look other places, unconventional places. Wound management, for example, really the best place to look is not in the hospital or the emergency department or the clinic, but it really is to look at veterinary medicine and home health care. You know, if you can put a bandage on a horse's leg and it'll stay, that's probably a pretty solid bandage, and it's likely to work well in a human in a difficult environment as well. So we have spent time looking at what other people are using.
That's very interesting, and it kind of something I hadn't even really thought about. But when I used to do a lot of canoeing when I was younger, I remember that one of the things that they had in the first aid kit was just a standard maxi pad. They would, because it was absorbent and it was inexpensive, and it did the job. And I think that's a good example of just improvising with standard materials. Getting a question from Chris Black in the chat room, wanting to know what your thoughts are about mass trousers. It seems they went out for a while. Now they seem to be creeping back in, at least in the pre-hospital trauma life support realm. What does that have a place in the field, or is it really just too much trouble to deal with?
Personally, I wouldn't take them. I mean, I think if somebody, if you have to apply mass trousers for somebody, number one, I find it hard to believe that they're going to be resurrected as a useful tool. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but I would be very surprised if they have a real place. But we'll see. But for a wilderness setting, you know, to carry a device that's relatively bulky, and we're going to use it to salvage somebody who's in such bad volume shock, and that's the only way that we, you know, they're not going to survive. Okay? So the simple answer to that question, no, I don't see any place for mass trousers in a wilderness context.
I think that's a point. We talk about triaging in mass casualty situations, and I guess part of what you might be doing in a wilderness EMS setting when you have a very severe injury is it's almost like you have multiple patients. You may only have one patient to deal with, but the sheer distance of transport and access to definitive care is such that you really are looking at a patient who has had a fatal injury. Is that something that you prepare or talk about?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, there are some people who are not salvageable, and I think that it's one of the most difficult things in a wilderness setting when you have a patient, you know how to fix the problem, but you can't, and you can't get them to where they need to be to get it fixed, and, you know, you watch them die. And knowing full well, you know, it's one thing for somebody to, you know, to have a massive head injury that no matter where you are, they're going to die. Or somebody who rips their thoracic aorta in a motor vehicle accident. You know, even if you've got the blood and the surgeon there, they're not going to survive. But what's really tough is when you have a person with a problem that a patient that's salvageable. If you could get them to help, but you can't, and then you sit and watch them die. You know, I think that's very difficult, and that's part of what can happen with wilderness medicine, as it can with disasters as well. You know, if somebody's trapped under a building, and you know they're there, and if you could just get them out, they'd be okay. But but you can't.
Yeah, Rick, that comes back around to looking at the issues surrounding people in a disaster setting where you can't get the equipment or materials you need in fast enough.
Well, I've been making a list of the parallels here on paper as we've been going through this, Jamie, and it seems to me it comes down to the following commonalities. That there's a delay in reaching or gaining access to the patient. We've got resultant traumas that are complicating underlying medical conditions. We have the lack of the ability to scoop and run with the patient or get to a different level of care. We have a need for protracted care in what can be considered a hostile environment. And now we start talking about the golden day versus that golden hour stuff, how long we're going to be here with the patient. And that leads us to simple injuries that would ordinarily be managed quite readily either in the hospital or in the everyday situation. And these simple injuries become complex and really could end up being multi-system problems as a result of being stuck in the wilderness for a period of time, or stuck in a building or in an urban environment which you can't extricate from. And that brings us around to advanced care being taken to the patient. And I think that the bottom line starts with the education and the training. And that was the fundamental paradigm shift that was mentioned right at the beginning when we talked about making a diagnosis rather than just taking the person to the hospital. And That little nugget, I think, is key in the difference and how we need to think both in the disaster setting and the wilderness setting.
Yeah, we have a concept that we call the big magnifier. Little things get big when you're a long way from help. And then we also talk about risk and consequence. So the risk of a specific injury when you're close to help is maybe no greater than the risk of the injury in a remote setting, but the consequences of that injury or that illness gets magnified significantly the farther away we are from definitive care or help.
That brings up a point to me when you talk about the magnifying aspects of relatively minor problems. How does Wilderness EMS address things that are more of a long-term care problem, like infection control, things like that?
Well, one way we do is try to pay attention to prevention. So one of the protocols is cleaning wounds and managing wounds and talking about good bandaging systems, what you can use to keep something clean, and then talking about the use of antibiotics. And again, this is an expanded scope of practice depending on where you are. I mean, you know, I have guys who work for me who are medics who travel overseas and take prolonged trips, and you know what? I write them prescriptions for antibiotics as appropriate for what it is that they're going to do, either for the anticipation of potential infectious diseases or wound infections. So yeah, I mean, we address it to straight up. The bottom line within an EMS system is going to be different than a person who's working as an individual who also happens to be a paramedic.
Okay. And I also noticed, I was looking through some sheets that an instructor, Wilderness EMS, had put up on his website about dealing with the secondary and primary surveys and focused history and physical. And one thing that jumped out at me, I'm currently a nursing student, and something I never did before I got in a nursing program was listen for bowel sounds. And yet, you know, when you're in a situation where you're looking at a 24 or 48 hour problem, you know, an absence of bowel sounds becomes more ominous and something that you'd want to do over time.
Well, yes and no. I've been practicing medicine for 30 years, and I have to tell you that my ability to make an important decision based on somebody listening to somebody's bowel sounds are limited. And then to take that and train somebody else to do it who's not going to have the opportunity to hear enough bellies that where there are abnormal bowel sounds. For me personally, I would say that that's of limited value. I would be paying attention to other things.
Fair enough.
I would be paying attention to pain. I would be paying attention to tenderness. Be paying attention to, you know, what the person's eating, if they're vomiting, you know, what other things are going on. I think most of the time you can bring pretty darn close. I'm interested in clarity rather than precision. It's less important for me to know as a wilderness practitioner that somebody has an acute appendix or a torsed ovary or an ectopic pregnancy. It's more important to me to have the clarification that this is an acute abdomen and it's not field fixable. And the nuance of auscultating bowel sounds and being able to put factor in deciding what to do or what not to do, I think it's probably pretty limited.
So we move on into a more critical patient. We talked a little bit about the hazards and stresses involved with having to make a decision and watch somebody die, essentially. Last month's episode, Dave, we talked about stress and EMS, and I wish this part of the topic had come up then, because that's something we really didn't even consider was the long-term stress of having to spend time with someone while they died and knowing that if you just had another... if you had, for want of a helicopter or an ambulance, you could get this person help that would save their life. When you're dealing with a CPR situation or a patient that's requiring long-term resuscitative efforts, what's the standard in Wilderness EMS?
I don't know that there's a standard, but our basic, you know, if somebody is in an arrest, you know, we stop within 30 minutes. If somebody's not going to turn around within 30 minutes, they're not going to turn around in 40 or 50 minutes. And there are certain times that we'll train our students, even first responders, not even to start with somebody who's in an arrest. You know, somebody who's been submersed for an hour or more. You know, there's no chance of survival, regardless of what the temperature is, particularly in a wilderness environment. You know, any trauma, basically, you know, really is doesn't have a chance of surviving. So we try to talk about, you know, when not to start, and if you do start, when to stop. And, you know, if you start doing CPR when it really doesn't make sense, you know, as often as not, you have to have your eyes open and understanding why you're going to start. It may be for a mental health reason, you know, the environment's safe. Nobody's going to get hurt or injured, and, you know, somebody that you know has gone into an arrest for whatever reason, and you may start even though you know that the chance of survival is zero, but you're doing it for everybody's mental health, so you feel like you've done something. But on the other hand, we've heard stories, and these stories happen every year. I mean, you can read them in the paper on a fairly regular basis. You know, if somebody who takes an unexpected screamer and they fall a couple of hundred meters and they're in a cardiac arrest and somebody does CPR on them for 2 hours. You know, it absolutely doesn't make any sense. And yet it still is done. And you know, I think we have to have the courage to say, no, you don't start. But this is a body recovery. This is not a rescue.
Is there a this question came up in the chat room, and Helen seems to have jumped in with an answer of her own, but I'd be interested in what your opinion is. We talk a lot about the golden hour in EMS. You know, we need to get the patient to definitive care. Is there a corollary in wilderness EMS, some time frame that you try to aim for, or is it just the mere fact that you're at a distance and there is no understandable time frame that defines the situation?
If there's a time, I don't know what it is. But obviously, the quicker the better. But more importantly, it's really having a clear understanding of what you have and what you don't have. You know, listing differential diagnoses don't help anybody. You know, this is either shock or it's not. This is a traumatic brain injury or it's not. This is a spine injury or it's not. This is a hypothermia or it's not. And the more clearly you can define, the clearer your diagnosis is, the easier it is to treat it. And, you know, whether we're in the wilderness or in the urban context, somebody's bleeding into their belly is going to die the same way. And the difference is that we don't have what we need to have to stop the bleeding in a wilderness context. So, you know, is there a specific time? No. People will die just in exactly the same ways in a wilderness that they will in the urban setting. One of the criticisms about wilderness medicine in the past, and I don't hear it as much anymore, but I hear it sometimes, is that, you know, there's two sets of rules. Well, there are not two sets of rules. The physiology is the same. The pathophysiology is the same. What changes is time. And you have more time for things to go wrong. And so if you have more time for things to go wrong, you need to have some modifications in the strategy on how to take care of it. But it's still predicated on the same understanding of physiology and pathophysiology. Okay? We all, if somebody's got a dislocated shoulder, we all manage a dislocated shoulder. It just makes sense if we're a long way from help that we can reduce it, because we know we can do it simply, we know we can do it without medications, and we can alleviate suffering and decrease morbidity if we do it in the field rather than wait the hours to get in for definitive care in the hospital.
Is there a gray area, and I don't know if it really focuses on what we're talking about now, but a gray area in the sense of the Hollywood version of wilderness medicine versus the actual application of wilderness medicine, we look at the actual treatment and protocols and those type of things. Are we in a situation that the treatment actually changes, you know, grabbing the pen and jabbing it in the throat to get an airway open, and kind of the foolishness that Hollywood gives us as an idea of what we're going to do in the woods? Is there a false mindset about what wilderness medicine is?
Yeah, I think if the mindset of wilderness medicine is that we're going to teach first responders how to decompress chests and do surgical airways, that's absolutely a misnomer as far as I'm concerned. Okay, why? Because you can't train, you know, for somebody to be trained in those kinds of techniques, they need to understand a lot more than a first responder is going to understand necessarily, and they need to have some practice. They need to be authorized to do that. I don't think that you can take somebody in a 70 or an 80-hour course and teach them how to recognize what a tension pneumothorax looks like and how and where to actually stick something into somebody's chest. And then if you go beyond that and say, well, we're going to improvise this with a pen, you know, I think that that's, I call that a party trick, okay?
Could this end up being a bad episode of MacGyver? Like, where's the gray area of medicine versus Hollywood?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And again, I would call those things party tricks. You know, it absolutely doesn't make sense. You know, good medicine is good medicine. And if you think you can take an untrained person and have them use a pen to form an airway, I think that anybody who would suggest to their students that they can train them to do that competently is doing them a great disservice. Okay? That doesn't mean that there aren't some things that they can do. And again, we've been teaching people to do spine assessments for way before Nexus was even a reality. And we've taught people how to reduce shoulders, you know, for example, for many, many years. And we get calls from students every year of how they've successfully reduced the shoulder. So we know that those things can work. And I guess, in a way, it's kind of in a buyer beware. There are absolutely people who are willing to teach students to do some things that I think are dangerously invasive in a context where they really don't have the opportunity to learn how to do it properly and understand the pathophysiology. I mean, again, I've been doing emergency medicine for 30 years, and I can promise you that I cannot always tell 100% if I do a physical examination who's got a pneumothorax and who doesn't. Okay, I can certainly be awfully suspicious and treat without an X-ray somebody's got a tension pneumothorax. You know, I do that. That's what I'm trained to do. But I also have a lot of experience. For somebody who's never seen a pneumothorax, to expect them to be able to properly stick a needle into somebody's chest is, risky at the very least.
Yeah, there's a good discussion going on in the chat room right now, Dave, about tension pneumos and people comparing their own protocols. Chris from Alabama says that he can decompress there as a paramedic, but only if the pressure is less than 60 systolic and tracheal deviation is present.
Well, he's not going to get to decompress very many of them.
That was my first thought. I don't think I've ever seen a deviated trachea.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual.
Pretty much later stage.
But again, you know, who are you going to train to do this? I think paramedics have the requisite didactic training. They've got the cognitive understanding and the opportunity to practice the skills. That's absolutely appropriate. But, you know, to say that, you know, well, we're going to teach somebody who doesn't have that kind of background to decompress a chest because we happen to be a long way from help, I think is risky at best.
I think that that's a good point that we'll kind of start to wind things down here. I'll start off with Rick and then John, and we'll wrap up with Dave. With any quick final thoughts about lessons learned or final impressions for you, Dave, that you'd like to leave us with about Wilderness EMS. Rick, go ahead, if you'd like, and just give me a few thoughts to finish out here.
Hey, I think this underscores, you know, like I call it the ripple effect of, the rule of outcomes, rather. The whole rule of outcomes says that there's so many similarities between what we do and the things we encounter, and this is another justification for doing this kind of training and thinking along the lines that we're talking about tonight. We don't have to wait for the earthquake or the wildfires or the snowstorms. We can encounter these types of things in the wilderness environment right around us every day as a matter of routine. And I just applaud you for bringing this comment or this content out tonight. And this has just been a great show, Jamie.
Well, I have to thank Dave for that because I really scrambled to try to get a guest, and his office was very helpful in putting me in touch with him. They're in Maine, he's in Texas, and still it's managed to work out. So it just kind of came together for us. John, any final thoughts from up in Canada?
Well, I have to say thank you. What a great show. Wilderness medicine has been something I've always been interested in studying and being part of, and just never get around to doing it. I've taken some, through the scouting movement as a youth. I've certainly enjoyed the outdoors, and to highlight and talk about it, it's certainly been exciting and fun tonight.
Dave, final thoughts from you. You get the last word, as it were.
All right. Well, thanks to Rick and John for participating. It's good to have them on board. I think that, if there's a parting word about wilderness medicine, it is, at the end of the day, just the practice of good medicine that stresses clarity, care and evaluation, and having a good understanding of physiology and pathophysiology to not only know what you have but what you don't have, and for those problems that you have, to have an understanding of where they can go so that you can help prevent them. And then I think the other part is, if you are the doc for the group, that you are in a wilderness setting working with other people, that your responsibilities, as we all know at EMS, is not just the patient, it's taking care of ourselves in a wilderness setting and taking care of all of our partners who are helping us in a rescue setting.
Well, Dave, I certainly appreciate you taking the time to join us here this evening on the MedicCast Live. And I want to remind everybody else that if you have any questions or comments on this show, you can reach me here at the MedicCast at www.medicast.com. You can also catch me by email at podmedic@mac.com. And if you'd like, you can call into the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. I want to thank Wilderness Medical Associates, and specifically Dr. David Johnson, who is their medical director and president, for joining us on tonight's show, and also our wonderful podcasting guests, John Bignell and Rick Rosati. It's great to have John back in the community and joining us again, and hopefully we'll be able to have John here again frequently in the future. Join us again next week. Well, I'll be back with another episode of the MedicCast. And for those of you here in the U.S., I want to wish you all a safe and happy Thanksgiving. Make sure that you're safe on the roads and get to your family gatherings all in one piece. That's going to wrap up the show. I will end, as I always do, by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.